Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, Assistant Professor of Communication and Media at Lund University. Remember, you can follow the show on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or visit us on the web at socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you're a news geek or perhaps working in journalism, then you're going to love this episode. My guest is Arjun Murthy. He is the co-founder and CEO of The Factual, which is a company that has developed an engine or a set of algorithms that ranks the credibility and bias of individual news articles. So underpinning the system are four metrics that are combined in order to give each article a factual grade. And those four criteria are the site's quality, the author's expertise, the diversity of sources in the news article, as well as the article's tone, whether it's opinionated or not. And we'll dive more into those specifics. But the point is that each article is given this factual grade. And using that kind of central rating system, the Factual offers a number of services. There's a newsletter. There is a site called isthiscredible.com where you can check individual articles. And there's also a Chrome extension that you can have articles in your Twitter or Facebook feed being rated by that algorithm. So it kind of plugs in and gives you the factual grade for the news that you come across in your feed. And I think this is really interesting on a couple fronts. One is that the system is not designed to be a fact checker, which is one of the kind of trending approaches towards trying to stop disinformation. It's not about verifying facts. It's more about trying to rate articles based on how dry and how balanced the coverage is. And there's a market for that. The second thing I think is interesting is that I like to do this from time to time on the podcast, is to talk to people who build systems that are designed in a way that's different from the mainstream social media platforms. So we did an episode a while back with PDVid, which was kind of an alternative video aggregator from YouTube. And The Factual is very much a similar idea in that it's a different type of news aggregator where it doesn't optimize for engagement. And that's the key difference between social media platforms with news on them like Reddit or Twitter or Facebook. Visibility is often decided by how popular articles are based on the user community. And obviously, that's very easy to game. So in other words, what happens when you change the incentive structures around how news is presented and how news is engaged with? And as I'll talk about, there seems to be some interesting things going on with anonymity, which we tend to think would increase the trolling and incivility of a conversation. But when you remove that engagement incentive structure, it seems to have quite the opposite effect. So all in all, really interesting. I love this conversation. Arjun has some great sound quality because he is also a podcaster. He hosts the Unbiased podcast, which is one of the services that The Factual offers. To be clear, this is not a plug or a promo for the service itself, but if you would like to check it out, you can go to thefactual.com or play with the rating system on isthiscredible.com. But without further ado, let me turn it over to Arjun Murthy. Again, he is the CEO of The Factual. Arjun, thanks for taking the time out and welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
Thanks very much for having me, Michael. I'm looking forward to this. And as I mentioned on email, slightly intimidated, but excited to have the conversation.
Nothing to be intimidated about. But why don't we start out by discussing a bit of the motivations behind developing The Factual before kind of getting into the specifics of the system itself? Because, I mean, there's been so much focus recently on fact-checking news. And from what I've read about The Factual so far, it seems less about verifying individual facts and more about scoring articles for their source credibility and level of opinion. So why did you decide to develop The Factual? And what are the key drivers for what the system aims to accomplish?
Sure. You know, if any startup founder is being totally honest, the reasons for starting a company are usually equal parts arrogance and naivety. You think you can solve a problem, usually using some sort of technology, and you're like, yeah, how hard could it be? And then you get in, you're like, oh my God, this is way, way harder than I thought. But, you know, if we wind it back, I've always been a news geek my whole life, to be honest. It's very corny, but my first job was a paperboy when I was 12 years old. I grew up in Canada, and I loved the job, and I loved delivering the newspaper, and it made my customers happy. They felt like they knew what was going on in the world around them. So Ever since then, I've always read the paper. I was the geek that had, you know, the subscription to the New Yorker when I was 19 for like 20 years. And what I found out in around 2015, 2016 was that the news wasn't really regarded as a valuable product anymore. So here was this thing that I grew up loving and thought that it was really, when it was done well, it made people happy and less anxious about the world. And now people just only spoke about the news in very bad terms and felt like it was completely worthless and just making them unhappy. And so I thought, well, I just exited the last startup I was at, which was a company called HubSpot. It was a great company and phenomenal people that I worked with there. And so I thought, okay, here's my chance to do something that is really close to my heart. If I could do something to help the news business, which I feel is so important, then that would be a good thing to do. And so I met my co-founder, the CTO. We had some ideas about how we could apply technology to improve the quality of news that people are receiving. And we jumped into it, and boy, it was tough. It took us a few years before we found product market fit, before we had a technology and then a product that people really wanted and were willing to pay for. But that's how we got into it. And in terms of what are the signals that we look for in our rating system, so you're absolutely right, Michael. We don't verify individual facts using an algorithm. In fact, I would argue it is extremely difficult for any algorithm to verify an individual fact in a scalable manner. Computers are not great at saying whether something is true or false. Computers are good at saying whether something has a high probability of being true or false. And so that's really sort of the core behind our engine. It can't say whether any individual fact in an article is true or false. It can say that an article in aggregate has a high probability of being highly credible, highly informative, or has a low probability of being highly credible and highly informative. And the way we determine that probability is we look at four major categories of signals. At a very high level, the thesis that we had was, when it comes to news, most news feeds in the world are driven by some sort of popularity. So likes, hearts, tweets, backlinks, something or the other like that. But when it comes to news, it's not necessarily true that popular articles are the most credible articles. And as we all know, in the last 5 to 10 years, sometimes the most popular articles are actually not particularly credible. They're quite inflammatory. And so when we set out to build our algorithm, we said, let us not worry about popularity signals. So when we designed the algorithm, we picked these four factors. We didn't care about popularity. What we did care about was, one, how well researched an article is. So we looked at quotes and links. And when we look at links, it's kind of like Google's PageRank algorithm in reverse. So, you know, PageRank with Google is who links to you, and then Google determines how authoritative you are. Well, we care about who do you link to and how authoritative are they. And so a big algorithm around linking and quotes, and we basically give an article an evidence score or a sources score. Then we have a second factor, which is how opinionated or neutral is the tone of writing. And so here we use a natural language processing algorithm that looks at an article and effectively scores how emotional the content is. It's not necessarily sentiment analysis. It's not whether it's positive or negative. We don't necessarily care about that. What we care about is how emotional the words are, or are they fairly neutral? And so it's a big, giant grammar engine, if you will. And so we get a score for how opinionated or not something is. And that really stems from the fact that, you know, people said, I feel like news is overly opinionated these days. I'd like something to not be very opinionated. I'd like to reach my own conclusions given the facts. So that's why those two factors were chosen. Get all the facts without a whole lot of opinion. Then the next factor is how authoritative or how much of a topical expert is the journalist? And so for this, every article that we rate is classified into a number of topic areas, and that journalist is tagged for that. And then our system over time starts to build a reputation grade for each journalist on what topics they write on, and do their previous articles, are they highly opinionated or not, and are they well-sourced or not? And so that generates an expertise rating over time. And at this point, we have a database of about 50,000 journalists and what they are experts at. So that's another fancy way of saying we're basically looking for beat reporters, people who cover something consistently, deeply will score well in our system. And then finally, the last is a source reputation score, which is effectively an average score for all the articles scored for a site, and it floats over time, so it allows it to go up and down, allowing a site to get better or worse, depending on the content they're putting out. We take all those four factors, we combine them in different ratios depending on the kinds of articles that we have. So political articles are weighted slightly differently than a sports article, for example. And then it spits out a number from 1 to 100, which is our very simplistic way of saying, is this article highly informative or not? And what we colloquially tell everyone, all of our tens of thousands of readers, is if it has a better than 75% grade, it's probably going to be quite informative.
Right. And I want to dive into kind of the back end of each of those criteria. But first, I'd like to ask you more about kind of the, you know, topical scope, because Facebook tried something not necessarily the exact same, but they had this news curation project back in 2016, where they contracted these 25 journalists to kind of promote news in this trending news feature that's long been scrapped since then. There's been a lot of controversy around that project. So maybe, as you were saying about popularity, that was probably, you know, one of the key drivers for those decisions. But in your view, why was that kind of news curation project flawed from Facebook's side? And how does the factual try to avoid some of the shortcomings that they had there?
So I don't know a ton about that particular project, or rather, I think I've forgotten about it because it's been a few years now. What I would say is that any system which is largely driven by people is going to be prone to bias. And while our algorithm, of course, was designed by people, my co-founder and myself, and I can talk a little bit about how we did our best to keep our biases out of the algorithm. But the point is that we have a consistent methodology of story selection, topic selection, and a methodology that's transparent. A methodology that also makes it more probable that stories from across the political spectrum are going to be surfaced. My recollection of Facebook's efforts is that first, if it's driven by humans, you're subject to sort of the collective biases of those people. Facebook historically has really struggled to find a political balance in its newsfeed. And I think it's easy to denigrate Facebook from far away because we don't have to make the decisions they do. I think their job is tough, but it seems like the hardest thing for Facebook, the reason why most projects fail, and possibly this one, is because they're at the very end driven by engagement. Everything in Facebook ultimately comes down to engagement. Because if it's not engaging, if it's not keeping you on the platform for longer and longer, then it's not as good for them. It's not as easy for them to show you ads. It's not as easy for them to retain you long term. And so they invariably will solve for engagement. And when you solve for engagement, that's when you start to get salacious stories, clickbait headlines, very inflammatory stories trending. If you try to trend, you know, the most factual stories, they're kind of boring, to be honest. You know, news, when it's done well, is a bit dull. It's just supposed to tell you what happened. It's not salacious. That doesn't do very well for engagement. So I suspect that in Facebook's case, those are some of the things, having humans which are biased, they're not transparent themselves. So you're like, well, why did this story? Why not this story? Aren't you guys biased about this or that? And then, frankly, if it's not salacious or gossipy or clickbaity, it can't get the engagement. And eventually, Facebook management's going to say, why are we doing this? You know, no one really seems to care about it. It doesn't seem to keep people. Let's get rid of it. In the factual, we don't care about engagement in the same way. We do care about frequency of use because I want to know that people are using us often and regularly so they're getting informed. But because we don't have any ads on our platform, it's a very low-cost subscription model, then all we care about is regularity of usage. And that means we don't track clicks and views and likes or anything of the sort. It doesn't really factor into the algorithm at all. And that makes it a lot easier for us to just suggest stories that are rated highly by our system, that are very informative, without a care in the world as to, is the headline really catchy? Who cares? I mean, that's not our job.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm thinking about this idea of engagement because, I mean, obviously publishers, a lot of them have changed their reporting to some extent in order to seek that engagement and to make themselves more popular on Facebook and get more reach on Twitter. Whereas I guess because the Factual isn't publishing news on its own, right? It's a kind of a news aggregator. It doesn't have to optimize for engagement. And so I'm wondering, are your subscribers catering to a group that's actually looking for this type of very balanced, maybe less salacious, perhaps boring news, that's actually what they're willing to pay for, is the news that is a little bit dry?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it, Michael. What shocks people is that the segment who want just plain old news is so immensely huge. Most people have this assumption about humans that we want the gossip and the salaciousness. And the truth is, we all kind of like it. It's fun. Yeah, who wouldn't say that? But to have it every day, day after day, on stories that are really important. This isn't Will Smith at the Oscars. This is important stuff around, you know, border security or Medicare policy or foreign policy or any of these sorts of things. Then when those are turned into entertainment-like stories, that sets off people's radar. Like, this is, I don't feel like I'm getting the facts here. I feel like you're leading me to a conclusion. And that really breaks people's trust. And so the biggest aha that we have at The Factual is that the people who read and subscribe to The Factual are an incredible cross-section of the US. We do have international users as well, although I must admit we're very heavily US at this point. And so we have readers in all 50 states across 3,000 zip codes, across a huge range of demographics. So we have CEOs that use us. We have homeless people, unemployed homeless people that subscribe to The Factual because it's $5 a month or $25 a year. It's so dirt cheap. We have people that are pastors who use it and actually have talked to their church attendees about it. We have ex-convicts that are subscribers. And so it's sort of the real gamut of everyone in society. And when we stratified the market, I think of the market as having three distinct segments of news users. The first is loyalists, people who really love some brand or some journalist, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Glenn Greenwald, Matt Taibbi, whatever, someone, Substack, somewhere, they really love it and they pay for it. Wonderful. There's about 20 million people of those, and all brands should play to their core audiences that they have to because it's a very tough marketplace. There's about 140 million people in the United States that frankly just don't care about news. They'll read whatever. It's in their feed, sure. TikTok, Facebook, I don't care. Swipe, 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 read. Great. By all means, monetize them with salacious stuff, ad-driven content, I don't care. But between these two segments are 100 million people that we call informed readers. And all they want is just give me the facts, cut out the spin, show me the angles, and then let me reach my own conclusions. Do it quickly. Don't waste my time. And that's the fundamental thing about this segment. Don't waste my time. They're busy. They have jobs, spouses, children, bills to pay, errands to run. We don't want to have them read news endlessly in a day. As quickly as we can, 5, 10, 15 minutes, great. You're caught up. You have the facts. There's a lot more if you have time, if you want to dig in. But if not, don't worry about it. You're good to go. That's a very different mentality when it comes to news than every other aggregator and news provider who's inherently thinking, how can I keep you reading more? And my job is, how can I keep you reading just what you need and then get out of here?
Mm. And so let's talk a little bit about the criteria and kind of how they're operationalized, because I think there's quite a few academics who are working on trying to classify news articles automatically, which is kind of what The Factual is doing under the hood. And you've mentioned the criteria already, but maybe we can take these first two ones together, which are the site reputation and journalist expertise. And I mean, why are these key metrics at the level of individual articles, and how are they actually calculated?
Yeah. So the reason that we wanted our system to calculate at an article level rather than a source level is because any source is a collection of reporters. Some are great at their job, some maybe not so much. And to have a single coarse metric to say a source is good or bad, we thought would really lend to just broad generalizations, would miss out on great writing. So one of the hypotheses that my co-founder and I had when we started is that there is great journalism in the world today. There are amazing reporters who do the hard work of deeply researching topic and give their readers and their audience complete context or as much context as they can on why something happened and how to connect the dots. That's the kind of journalism that we loved and we wanted to make sure that we would surface. So we always saw our job as being a search engine, find great news. We're not writing news ourselves. We're not journalists. We're a bunch of tech guys. So it was find great news. And we thought when we operate at the article level, we were more likely to find it. In terms of the criteria you mentioned, so on the opinionated side, as I said, when we talked to people and said, you know, what do you want to see in news? Like, what makes for good news for you? And we talked to lots and lots of people, and they said kind of the same four things over and over again, which is the four factors. So they said, I want something that's really well-researched. I mean, isn't news supposed to be all about evidence? I want something that's not very opinionated because I'm tired of opinions. I feel like everything's opinionated. I want to reach my own conclusions. I want something that's written by a topical expert. I don't want something that, you know, is written by a guy who writes on sports one day and politics the next day, or is sitting in Macedonia and pumping out a bunch of spam. I want someone who really knows what they're talking about. And then I'd like it to be from a reputable source. Those are the four things that people kept saying over and over again, and we just turned that into code. So we do use information from all sides and from Media Bias Fact Check for the political bias ratings, but that actually doesn't factor very much into the grade overall. So the political bias ratings are mainly provided as a directional guide for readers. So it'll say, you know, the New York Times, moderate left, or Washington Examiner, moderate right, or something like that. And what that is a guide for readers to say, hey, this source tends to frame stories from a liberal perspective or from a conservative perspective. They tend to be very blunt about it if you're, you know, hard right or hard left, or they tend to be more sort of subtle about it if you're moderate. That's really all political leaning. That's about as much as it factors into the system. The actual grade itself, the 1 to 100% grade, we don't care if you're left or right or hard left or hard right, because we assume that all reporters and really all sources have some bias. Because they all have some frame of reference. We're humans. We have some frame of reference. We grew up in a certain place. We have an idea of how the world works. So when we write, we'll operate in that frame of reference. And that's okay. I mean, not only is it very hard to get rid of, I'm not sure you need to get rid of it entirely. But what it does mean is that as a reader, no single article or source is going to be the complete truth on a topic. It's just not possible. You have to read more than one article on a topic, and ideally from different points in the political spectrum, because that's when you see the story framed in different ways and you can start to understand, oh, okay, I can see how this is a complicated topic. I'm not just seeing one side. So the way that I think about it is the political leaning tells you how the story might be framed. The grade tells you, is the story any good? Because it's not just good enough to say, why don't I just watch CNN and Fox? I mean, you could. You are getting the left and the right point of view to some degree, but it's often really terribly done. It's very salacious. It's really opinionated. And what most research has shown, I think historically, is that when you see something that's very opinionated, that is counter to your own understanding of an issue, you typically just dig your heels into your own understanding. You're like, ah, those guys are kooks. You know, I'm going to stick to what I know. But if you read a different point of view that's very well done, it's informative, it's thoughtful, it's not very opinionated, then you're more likely to open up your mind and say, huh, I hadn't thought of it that way. I mean, I don't know if I agree with it, but that's kind of interesting how you can see it in a different direction. And that's really what we want to do. We want to help people see those different angles that are thoughtfully done, that are well researched, so that people can open their minds up to different points of view and different ideas. You don't have to change your mind. And frankly speaking, I don't think our service will necessarily change people's minds in a lot of cases. I do think it will make people not hate other people so much who have different points of view, because you'll understand, okay, I can get why you have a different point of view on this. I don't have to agree with it, but I don't think you're crazy. I can understand your logic. That's really what we're trying to do at the end of the day.
Hmm. And I thought one of the cool things, so there's a bunch of different services that I've talked about in the introduction. There's the website, Is This Credible?, where you can check individual articles, but there's also the platform. And when I was on the platform, what I thought was really cool is that, I forget exactly what the terminology is, so you might have to correct me, but you're able to find, like, by using this constant factual grade, and not really paying attention to the source as much, you can basically discover news that's kind of under-visible or under-reported. So basically, you might have a very, very high-ranking article from a less-known source, but that's something that your platform will promote because it's detecting what are getting the highest factual grades. And I thought that was cool because there was some interesting stories there that I would have missed absolutely by, because I wouldn't know how to search for them, or the aggregators I go to wouldn't normally display those sources. So I think there is some really cool value to having a standard metric that's kind of source agnostic to an extent, except with the source reputation being built in there.
That's right. Yeah. And that sort of goes to that initial thesis that I was saying that, you know, there is great journalism in the world today. It's just hard to find because there's so much terrible journalism and highly popular journalism that dominates the airwaves. So our system groups all articles into topics. And so, for example, if, you know, last week, probably the biggest story in the country was Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson being nominated to the Supreme Court. So there was thousands of articles on her nomination, which is great. So we grouped them all into topic pages. If you want to go into KBJ's nomination, here's all the stuff. And that, by grouping into topics, we can, about 95% of news sort of groups into topic pages. And then about 5% doesn't group into topic pages. And that's where it gets really interesting. It's like, huh, this one story doesn't seem to fit in anywhere else and is really highly rated. Is that something that's interesting? And that's how it sort of shows up in the underreported section. And you find amazing stuff. And frankly, you know, most people in the news business know this, that the news is sort of a feeder system. A lot of times the smaller outlets, regional or local or specialty magazines or something, will pick up a story and they'll be the first to report on it. It'll be very interesting. And then sort of the bigger outlets will say, oh, that's cool that they did that. Let's do a bigger piece, or let's run that and add some of our flavor to it. And then eventually it becomes a topic. So by doing underreported, you find really interesting stuff, sometimes really challenging assumptions on stories. And that's the kind of stuff that our system tends to surface more.
Yeah, they're super cool. And so I went on to the isthiscredible.com and checked a few articles just to see, you know, how is this ranking? And it seemed like it worked out. I mean, I put a bunch of opinion pieces in there and it was ranked as highly opinionated. So something's working there with the NLP. But I had a question that I'm sure some of the academics listening are thinking about, and it's, how do you go about actually validating the scores to kind of make sure that they're accurate? So like if an article gets a 95% on the factual grade, is there kind of a human step to go in and help train the algorithm to say, yes, you're on the right track, or no, you're not?
Yeah, it's not, I wouldn't say it's terribly regimented because, you know, we've built this algorithm now, it's been in operation for about 4 years. And we really, most of the pure technical work on the algorithm was done, I want to say, more than 2 years ago. So it's been very stable for at least 2 years. And periodically, we will tweak it when we get feedback or we see something that looks off. And so what I mean by it's not very regimented, it's not like I have a review session of here are the, you know, top 10 that were rated high and low, and let's take a look and see what was on and what was off on it. But once in a while, we'll see something. We have editors who help polish up our daily newsletter, which is sort of our flagship product because it makes it so easy to get caught up. So nearly everyone signs up for the newsletter. That's where they start. And so in the newsletter, what we do is the algorithm spits out all its recommendations for what should be in the newsletter and what are the best viewpoints and blah, blah, blah. And then we have editors that go in and review it and check that the algorithm didn't get anything wrong, make sure that if it's suggesting multiple perspectives, that they are different perspectives versus effectively the same, et cetera. And so when they're doing that, they read a lot of news at night. And so, you know, as we're preparing the newsletter. And so they will usually surface it to me and say, hey, Arjun, this article got a X score, and that seems weird to me because I read it, I didn't really get the sense, and I'm looking at the breakdown. You know, you can click the grade details as you did, Michael, on Is This Credible, and you can see what we spit out. So sometimes there are technical reasons we get it wrong, link extraction was wrong, or author tag could not be extracted, or other sort of technical limitations. Sometimes the system just gets it wrong. The NLP engine, it's good, but it needs tweaking sometimes. They're just words and phrases it misunderstands. It doesn't quite get context on some phrasing. And so usually one of the harder things to get for our NLP engine is sarcasm, because sarcasm, you sort of have to have wit. you have to be human to pick up on it. Otherwise, it just looks like a bunch of words and it doesn't necessarily drip with emotion. And so sometimes it'll get it wrong. So when we see that, then we look at it and then my co-founder and I will go and analyze it and say, okay, what are the telltale signs that this was emotional? Did we miss something? Is there something we need to tweak in the dictionary? Because there's basically a giant dictionary or the grammar rules that we use, et cetera. And it's a little bit of a patchwork, but the original training set that we used was really bland writing, typically Reuters or sometimes even just text passages. I think we used some from proceedings document, I want to say. I don't know if I use C-SPAN or something, but it was like really bland stuff just to teach the system that if you're just trying to pump out, you know, text, this is what it looks like without sort of leading the witness. But Reuters was a very helpful training set in that regard. Not so much AP, actually. I'd say Reuters was the blandest of all.
Yeah, I have some questions about this kind of cumulative effect of running the algorithm. But first, I'm curious, where do you get the news articles from? Because you get 10,000 articles per day. How do you actually access those articles to feed into the system?
Yeah, so we basically have a crawler, much like a Google Spider, and it crawls a bunch of sites. It also fetches articles from Twitter feeds or RSS feeds. Usually RSS is probably the biggest input that we have. And a lot of news sites still make a lot of their articles available from RSS. So our engine can access it, fetch the articles. And because we are effectively a search engine, we are treated the same way a Google Spider is, which is that sites want us to index them. So we are able to fetch the articles, analyze, index, all that stuff. But we ourselves never serve up an article. You know, we're always an aggregator in that sense. We provide a link, maybe a little snippet, but we're always driving traffic back to those sources. And that's very important because we want those sources to get the credit. They did the work, right? So we're just saying we apply a layer on top to find great stuff, but we want to send you back to the people that did all the great work. So that's how we get all the news every day.
Interesting, which is kind of more how the you know, there's all these discussions around Web 3.0 and whatnot. We've talked a bit about on the podcast where I think this is kind of the more pure form of how the web should work, right? Linking back and aggregating rather than kind of platformizing the news.
Yeah, I don't have a strong opinion yet on Web 3. I'm still in a learning phase and reading about it. So I don't know yet if it is highly applicable to what we do. There is one part that's interesting. So I don't know if you noticed, Michael, we have discussions on thefactual.com. So from our daily newsletter and our app and the website, there's a daily poll and discussion on some trending topic. So I think yesterday's was about private space flight travel because it was the first all private crew that docked at the space station and whether it was ethical given what we have in this day and age. And I think today's has to do with former President Trump's culpability on the January 6th attack. And basically the committee saying that he is culpable, but it's unclear whether the DOJ will charge him. So we ask a question in a very simple manner with a yes, no, unsure sort of methodology. So should President Trump be prosecuted? Yes, no, unsure. And what's very interesting is that the way we do these discussions shows how you can have really thoughtful discourse and disagreement that's civil if the incentives are done right. And so I'll tie this back to Web3 in a second, but the long and short of it is, at least for us, we didn't need anything fancy like Web3. So when you vote on a poll in The Factual and you have an optional comment on why you voted this way, first of all, it's all anonymous. And that makes it much more plausible that people will vote honestly without fear of political backlash or, you know, fighting with their family or getting fired at their company or anything of the sort. So they really vote and talk how they want to. But behind the scenes, our system rates comments for insight and quality just like it does articles. So it looks at tonal analysis. It looks at length. It looks at whether they're sources. It also looks at a very interesting signal, which is, does this commenter, even though they're anonymous, do they have a pattern of reading consistently? The thesis being, if you read news consistently, you might know something. And if you don't read news consistently, maybe you don't know anything. And so the idea is we want to surface comments from people who know something. It's not about whether you have a PhD from some fancy university. It's, are you a habitual reader? Not do you read 100 articles in a day? I don't care about that. Do you read regularly? Is that part of your modus operandi? And what we found is that when we use all these signals, we find really good and thoughtful commentary. It's not inflammatory. It's insightful. And you can see different points of view. And we have a like button equivalent. It's called a respect button. It's kind of a cutesy thing. But the idea is, you know, you can respect something even if you disagree with it. And we do little things like when you respect a comment, there is no counter. You don't see that a comment has 5 respects or 6 respects. You respected it. Great. The recipient will find out how many respects they get, but nobody else will know. So we remove some of the performative aspects and the popularity-driven engine that is typical in other places. So these kinds of simple incentive systems and this respects model that, you know, you accumulate respects just by reading, you don't have to talk. You can be a quiet person and you just read consistently, you gain respects in our system. And when other respected people respect you because you need a certain level before you're allowed to respect a comment, then it makes you feel better because someone who's really actually well-respected in the community thought what you said was good. And only you know it. No one else is going to know it. It's not like there's a leaderboard or something. But it removes some of this performance nature. So all this is to say that it provides the end result that I think we all want, which is thoughtful commentary and discourse and even disagreement. But we didn't have to do anything fancy with Web3 on ownership and tokens and all kinds of stuff. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we should in the future, something like that. But for now, we have a really simple system and it seems to work fine.
Yeah, I couldn't leave a comment because I didn't have 5 respects yet. But
oh, you can leave a comment, but you can't respect someone else's comment.
Ah, that's what it was. That's what it was. But it's really interesting because, I mean, I think what the academic research tends to show is that anonymity generally leads to more extreme opinions, more trolling because you're not tied to your personal identity. But I think it's really interesting how you track these kind of, track has this connotation to it, but you know, yeah. that you're looking at the user level, are they actually reading articles? Reminds me a little bit of what Twitter did with this friction, right? Like, did you read this before you retweet it? And then you can actually highlight thoughtful commentary based on people who are informed because they're reading news on the platform.
That's right. Yeah. At the end of it, you know, it really, to me, all these systems boil down to incentives. What do you want to encourage your readers to do? And it really starts at the business model. Because we are not an engagement-driven platform, we don't care about the metrics that most everyone else does. And it really frees us up from a design standpoint. We don't have to care whether people got a whole bunch of upvotes. We don't have to care that the number of upvotes is a big factor in driving visibility. All that really, really changes the game for us. And I think for Twitter and Facebook and all these platforms that really struggle, sorry about the background noise, that's my dog.
No worries.
For all these platforms that really struggle with trying to balance high quality information and sort of engagement, that's a tough trade-off for them to do and one that we don't have to do as much of.
Yeah, it's interesting to kind of hear about the these small changes in design and the impact they have. I mean, we kind of know that Facebook and Twitter are driven by engagement and whatnot, but it's interesting how just a slight change here and there can make such a difference. But one of the other features of the Factual is that you can actually download a Google Chrome extension that will check and rate the news on your Facebook and Twitter feed. So I want to ask you about that. And I know it says on the website that you don't collect so much data from the extension at the user level, but I guess you must have some idea of how the ratings have evolved on Facebook or Twitter over time. So have you noticed that those ratings have gotten perhaps higher or lower over time, or do they tend to change around certain time points, like elections, for example?
Yeah, that's a good point. We did do some analysis, but it's not specific to Facebook or Twitter. So in all honesty, the Chrome extension, the browser extension, is really just yet another input into our crawler, if you will. We don't actually use it to do a whole lot of user-level information. It's just, I'm glad people are reading with our extension because it helps our engine get more and more articles to rate. That's really it. Mm. In terms of have scores gone up or down on these platforms over time, because the platforms have such different feeds for any person, I think taking the data based on what our Chrome extension users see and saying, let's extrapolate from that and say, therefore, this is what's happening on those platforms, That might be a little dicey because I don't know for sure that people who use our Chrome extensions are necessarily representative of what everyone is seeing on those platforms. I don't think we've gone there yet. What we do, however, is when we look at our whole corpus of data, which is, like I said, about 10,000 articles a day, and now we've rated over 10 million articles, we can do all kinds of trend analysis. So we can look at all the articles from a source or all the articles on a topic and see what's been going on with those grades. So some of the really interesting things are during the elections, we would look at how grades have been trending, especially by topic or even just generally on political news. And they generally dropped a lot when the election started. This was, I think, I want to remember when this was. This was the primaries, 2020, just before all the pandemic stuff. We started to do a whole bunch of analysis. And oh my goodness, there was like a steep drop in the quality of writing because reporters were pounding out so much political news because it was hot. People wanted to read it. And it was really quite poor on average. So we definitely have seen trends like that. But I couldn't extrapolate to say whether Facebook or Twitter are any worse than what you would see elsewhere.
Gotcha. And I mean, I think as anyone who's worked with trying to do anything automated, that, you know, it really depends on the quality of the input data. And I know on your website, you list some of the challenges that you've had or some things that the algorithm struggles with. For example, picking up embedded tweets as sources or citing journalists when the outlet doesn't give the name of the publisher, like The Economist, for example. So what are some of the hardest challenges you faced with the data or processing in terms of getting the system to run?
Yeah, so it's actually a fairly a laborious system to build. I think, you know, conceptually, you're like, okay, yeah, you extract a bunch of factors, you run some algorithms, you spit out a rating, I got it, you know. The actual work on making it happen is brutal. And it starts with the very basic observation that there is no standard in metadata for how news is done. There is no standard author tag or source tag or date tag or anything. And so our system had to be tuned heavily, oftentimes per source. We had to go in and make sure that our extraction engine was pulling the metadata correctly for that source. And luckily, sources don't change their format too often. So it generally, once you've done it, you're done with that source. But, you know, as we scale over time, it's the kind of maintenance that you have to do to make sure that all the information is correctly extracted. And then there are just limitations that are somewhat by design as well. So, well, there are environmental limitations. For example, our engine only understands English at this point. So non-English speaking, we can't rate yet. We could do the link analysis, of course, and to some degree a quote analysis, but not tone analysis, for example. But there are other things, like, for example, if John Smith writes for The New Yorker and John Smith writes for The Washington Post, our system will treat that person as two different John Smiths. It can't know that those are the same reporters. And we actually argue that's a good thing because when John Smith writes for one publication or another, he still has to go through some editorial layer and some editing policies that is often specific to that publication. So we want to treat his writing at one publication different as his writing from another publication.
Or maybe there's two John Smiths.
Yes, even more. And frankly, that's the one I worry about the most, is the ambiguity that we can't resolve. Now, sometimes a journalist might put a Twitter handle in their bio, and maybe you can use that as a canonical identifier for that journalist, but it's dicey. It's definitely not pervasive or 100% there. And so we just said, okay, fine, they're two different people. Let's treat them that way. So what it means is when journalists move from one publication to another, they do have to rebuild their expertise score in our system. It doesn't take a terribly long time, but it does take some time. So those are some of the challenges that we have.
Definitely. And I'm sure many of the listeners can share with the idea of, oh, it sounds so simple. And then trying to build it, it doesn't work. But I think this is kind of interesting. I was reading one of your posts on Medium where you were talking about previous names of the factual. So it used to go by Civic Owl or Owl Factor. Maybe some of our journalist listeners would recognize those as well. And you talk about how important it is to name a company correctly. And so I'm curious if you could kind of elaborate on that and your experience there, because there are academics who are building systems. Like we have one, I forget which university it's out of, but it's like a bot detector. And I don't know if it's botometer or botometer. But I think as people are, you know, developing their fact-checking systems or their depolarization algorithm or whatever it is, I mean, I think that naming idea behind it is actually quite important, I think, as your experience shows.
Yeah, it's a big deal. But again, it's a big deal if you're going to build a consumer class product for general purpose use. If you're building something for researchers or you're going to be selling it to other companies in a B2B fashion, the name matters a little less. It's when it is an end consumer product that the name matters a lot. So for us, we did so many mistakes when it came to naming, but very quickly, we started with Civic Owl because our initial purpose was that there was sort of a civic mission to what we were doing. And, you know, our first idea was people would tell us, why bother reading the news? You can't do anything about it anyways. So our very first idea was, oh, well, what if there was this button, which we called the Give a Damn button, and that button was attached to articles. And when you clicked it, it would analyze the article, understand the topic it was about, look at your geographic location, say, oh, you're reading about criminal sentencing. You're sitting in New York City in the zip code. Here are your local, state, federal representatives. Here's what they said about it. Click here to share this article with them, contact them, phone them, whatever. And people are like, oh, that's cool. And we built it and it mostly worked, but no one used it. And we asked them why. And that's when they said, well, I don't know if the thing I'm reading is good anyways. I don't even know what I would tell my senator. I'm not sure I want to share this with them. I want to be educated first. And so that's how we got on the path of, oh, you want to be educated? Let's write an algorithm that can show you really great news. And so as we morphed into that, then the old name of Civic Owl didn't make as much sense. Furthermore, it was spelled C-I-V-I-K-O-W-L because we couldn't get C-I-V-I-C-O-W-L. It turns out that a spelling mistake in a name, while cute, is actually a terrible idea when it comes to consumer software because people will always misspell it or spell it the right way. They're like, I went to Civic Owl with a C and it wasn't there. I'm like, damn it. So we renamed it to Owl Factor, which was internally the name of our algorithm. And we thought, well, you know, Google gets away with a crazy name like Google. We could get away with Owl Factor. That was also a terrible idea. Try saying the word Owl Factor on the phone to someone. And they're like, all, like A-L-L? No, Owl, O-W-L. It's like, okay, if you have to spell the name of your company, you're cooked. So that was another bad mistake. And then we landed on the Factual, which is much, much easier to say on the phone. It's also really a good stand-in for what we're trying to do in the business. What are we trying to do? We're trying to help people get factual news. So maybe if anyone's listening to this and they're trying to learn from our mistakes, I would say early on, you know, you could almost go with a generic name like Nuco or, you know, Stealth Product, whatever, just pick some stupid name for legal reasons. And then when you have product market fit, when you have people loving your product, using it daily, talking to people about it, then you can say, why do people like us? What do they see in us? And that's really your ticket to naming something. It's, you know, the best companies are driven by customer feedback. And it was our customers that were telling us, this is what I like about you guys. This is back when we were called Owl Factor. And I was like, oh, okay, that helps. And then it made it easier to pick the name.
Super interesting. And last question for you, I'm sure this will open up a can of worms maybe, but about naming and AI, artificial intelligence for news. I mean, we're hearing more and more about AI news curation or, you know, the fully automated AI newsroom. And you've done a ton of work building the system. As you said, it was kind of a lot of manual getting the author tags, et cetera. And I'm sure you've participated in many discussions about AI with journalists and publishers. And so I'm curious to get your thoughts on, you know, is the algorithm underpinning the Factual AI, or is it kind of latching on to this industry buzz? And kind of either way you fall on that, where do you see the next innovations in machine learning when it comes to journalism?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I will admit our system is not AI in the sense, in the true sense of the word. We do say it publicly and on marketing materials because honestly, it's just easier to say it that way. If I say ML, NLP, I just lose everyone. And so for marketing purposes, I apologize wholeheartedly to the public, but we use the word AI because it's easier. But if we're talking to technical people, no, I don't think what we have is truly AI. What we have is machine learning. And machine learning is a whole class of algorithms that I'm sure a lot of your listeners understand. So yeah, there's a, you know, the author expertise is a great example of machine learning, right? Over time, it's progressively learning what people, these authors, are good at, what their specialties are, and how good they are at it. that's a machine learning feedback loop type learning system. NLP is typically associated with ML as well, sort of learning and rating, but you have to have feedback loops. You've got to be telling the system, you got this right, or you got it wrong, or you were off by this much, and then it gets better over time. So it's a little bit more manual sometimes in that sense, but yes, there's a learning system there. But other parts are deterministic. So for example, the evidence scoring system on links and quotes is more deterministic. It's not truly an ML system. It's not like it's learning over time what is a more evidenced article. It's just, you know, it rates how much you have. And the more you have, the better you have. There's sort of a bunch of math applied to it so that they're diminishing returns. It's not like an article with 40 links is much, much better than one with 35 links, for example, or something like that. You know, so there's some math behind the scenes, but it's more deterministic than I would say it's a feedback loop model. So yeah, I would say we are a mixture of ML algorithms, NLP algorithms, and deterministic modeling and mathematics. I wouldn't say we are truly AI in the sense of it doesn't really know. I guess maybe it depends on what you think is AI. I think of AI as a very powerful system that really understands what it's doing, has a concept, can intuit or posit conclusions that the designers never expected. And I don't think I can really say our system does that. Maybe, I don't know, maybe my co-founder will correct me. I don't think we really do. And so, yeah, I think for people that are technical, I would be much more cautious with using those terms.
Yeah, no, I think, One interpretation of AI in journalism would be to self-write the news, right? Have a system that develops headlines.
Yeah.
And I mean, and Google has this, right? It's this TP3 or whatever it's called, which is just just NLP. I think I agree with you that I think the key marker of AI is when it does something that no one predicts, or it does something that seems counterintuitive, but then the AI turns out to be correct in the end. And I don't think many systems have made that jump.
I think that's right. And yeah, and to the second part of your question, sorry, I didn't answer that earlier, you know, what does the future hold? Of course, that's anyone's guess. I think that the future holds that you want a combination of humans and machines involved in the news, and each playing to its strengths. So the strength of a machine and algorithms is that it can process tons and tons of information quickly, and it can do it in a consistent manner. And with our exploding information landscape, you know, we're rating 10,000 articles a day, and arguably once we go to international languages, it's going to be 3 to 4x that at least. It's just too much for humans to keep up with. You need engines and machines and algorithms to make sense of the madness. But the strength that humans bring that at least to date machines cannot do is humans really understand context. You know, okay, let's say that an AI can write an article saying there was a skirmish today in the West Bank and a rocket was fired and 7 Palestinians were killed or 5 Israeli soldiers were killed. And this is what happened. Okay, great. That's true. So what? What is that? How is that helping me understand what's going on? You need the context and the history, what came before, what might have happened after, who said what did they say? How does it relate to what happened last week or last month or last year? And is it related to that treaty discussion that's going on between the governments or, you know, whatever other thing? That kind of rich context is so critical for news. And I submit that at least as of this moment, I don't think AI can do that very well. But humans can. We're good at that stuff. And that's where I think we want the pairing of machines and humans. Let the machines sort out the good from the bad. Let them cut out the crap. Let them help journalists find important and informative sources and information. But then let humans do the stitching and pull the context together to make it the most useful for the reader. And yes, I know that's going to bring in some biases of humans, but that's where I submit that humans need to get better at reading more than one source. Just don't take any one as gospel. And then I think the system works well together. So my perhaps idealistic, maybe hopeful view of the future is that there's a combination of humans and machines, each doing what it does best, so it keeps us on the straight and narrow. And if I can take one sort of excursion from that, you know, that's maybe very timely as well, I think about self-driving cars, and I think having AI systems and machines helping you drive safely is such a good idea. because car accidents are numerous and horrible. And we want to cut that down to zero if we could, or as low as we can. But we also want humans involved because the machines might get it wrong sometimes, and humans need to take control and remember that the liability is on them, not on the machine, to make sure that this machine is operated correctly, this car is operated correctly. And so there's some sort of hybrid model that I hope we end up at, where the machine is always watching out and making sure it's picking up on errors that a human might make, but the human's still there and driving and understands that it's you. You have to drive this thing and make sure that no one gets hurt from one end, you know, from point A to point B as you drive. Then I think we reduce fatalities while still keeping humans engaged with what they're doing.
Yeah, thinking about humans and machines. I mean, there's no harm in having a machine rank some news for you and then you to draw your own conclusions from it. So Arjun, thanks so much for taking the time out and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you very much, Michael. This was really a pleasure and appreciate the very thoughtful questions. I hope everyone listening got a lot out of it as well.
I've just been speaking with Arjun Murthy, co-founder and CEO of The Factual. There'll be some links down in the episode description, as well as a link to the Unbiased podcast. And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in, and special thanks to Evan for hooking up this episode. I've got a string of recordings coming up, so I'm prepping for those, and as they're finished, I'll be dropping them into your feed, so keep an eye out for that. But until then, I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Malmo. See you next time.